Welcome to Speed Vector, the podcast dedicated to the art, risk, and obsession of speed flying. I'm your host, Victor Garcia, speed flyer, skydiver, cinematographer, Navy veteran, and full-time gravity junkie. Every week, we dive into the lines we fly, the gear we trust, and the stories that push us past the ridge and into the void. Whether you're just learning to launch or chasing the perfect line, this is where speed flyers come to connect, learn, and stoke the fire. This is Speed Vector. Today's guest is someone who redefines what's possible in the mountains. Jason Hardrath is an endurance athlete and adventure record setter best known for completing 100 fastest known times, a milestone no one had ever reached before. From volcano link-ups to remote alpine traverses, he's built a reputation on grit, strategy, and creative mountain objectives. He's also a teacher, a storyteller, and a leader in human performance world, showing how mindset and discipline carry over far beyond sport. In this conversation, we dive into his philosophy on suffering, flow, and purpose, what it takes to push the limits safely, and how ordinary people can unlock extraordinary goals. After a difficult bout with COVID in 2021, he shifted his focus to paragliding, approaching it with an all-in mentality like he had done so many times before. He worked his way down to smaller wings and eventually began speed flying. He has flown all over the world and has a lot of amazing stories to tell. Welcome, Jason Hardrath, to episode 22 of the Speed Vector podcast. Enjoy.
I'm still learning how to like interview people. So it's not really an interview, right? I say this to like everybody I've had on. I'm like, don't expect me to be like NBC Sports because I am not that. I'm just a dude that's passionate about, you know, flying.
Wait, I thought this was on ESPN 8, The Ocho.
The Ocho. Yeah, if there was an Ocho, it would be on the Ocho, 100%. I love that. That's classic. Classic. Well, Jason, thanks so much again for being willing to come on the show. I think it's super cool. We almost crossed paths in Chelan, but I had work stuff I had to go home and take care of over the weekend. So I'm bummed that we didn't get to meet in person. We were going to do this in person, but you know, as the winter approaches, my life gets a lot busier. So thank you for coming on virtually.
Here we are.
Here we are. And you are in your office in the school that you are the physical education teacher at, correct?
Yeah, I'm here at Bonanza Elementary out in the middle of nowhere. Bonanza, yeah, you can Google it if you want to find it, people. Yep, Oregon, Southern Oregon. It's a little one gas station town. They bus kids from all over. It's a high poverty school. One of the things that's kept me here is it feels like I have a really big impact with these kids because they don't get to interact with somebody that travels the world and climbs peaks and runs ultra marathons and flies off of things. So yeah, it's a cool school. I've got all my old bib numbers hanging up behind me, for people that are listening to this and can't see any video. And it's in my PE office, so it provokes conversations with students about life and discipline and living an adventurous story with your life and that it's worth it. And I think it adds a lot of authenticity to my program that, you know, when I ask them to do something, not only will I do it with them, but I can tell them why it matters and have like real evidence as to it's like, yeah, like we're running the mile right now and working on your endurance, someday you're going to look up at a mountain and you're either going to go, oh, I wonder what it looks like from up there, or you're going to go up there. And I tell them, being the guy that goes up, being the girl that goes up is way better than being the one that stands at the bottom wondering.
Oh, so, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, PE was my favorite class through grade school and high school even. And when I stopped having the ability to have a PE class, it was extremely bummed. That was like, you know, my guaranteed A, you know, or however it's graded. It probably wasn't even like a, you know, regular grading scale. It was like pass or fail, but I was like super stoked on it. And I will say, like, if I had a PE teacher like you, I would have been probably still where I'm at today, but it would have been cool to have that kind of inspiration in front of me. Cause you know, I grew up watching movies. You know, I was really into films, like into like action sports films and films about Everest. And I had all these, you know, I still do have like huge dreams of climbing big mountains and flying off them, to be honest. But to actually have someone in person that's like you can ask direct questions to has got to be just like, I guess what I'm saying is I hope that there's some of those kids or even one of them knows like how special that is. Because it's, you know, not everybody does what you do, and we'll get into what you do because it's a lot bigger than flying, but flying definitely ties into it, which is super cool. So, but yeah, thanks for, I guess, thank you for being a PE teacher and being an inspiration to the youth, because that's cool, and I feel like
I think it's one of the things that's driven. I mean, I've always been driven. I was the ADHD. You know, when you said PE was like a class you did well, and it was the same for me. I thrived in environments where I could have physical movement and physical challenge and pursue those kinds of things. That was an area I found positive identity because I really struggled socially and I struggled to sit still in school. I created all sorts of problems for my family from school or church or any institution where I had to sit down and behave. Because I was impulsive. I was wild. I was rambunctious. I couldn't sit still. My mind was always going 1,000 miles an hour in 1,000 different directions. And so... yeah, to have that, lived that myself, and how difficult that is in a society that says sit down, shut up, do what you're told. Finding that you can thrive not sitting down and not shutting up, and instead going and doing big things and taking on big challenges, and others being inspired because of it, and then you get to talk about it, then they want you to talk. It's like, hey, wait, here's a whole different path. And I genuinely think it's essential for all of us, like whatever it is we're doing, like take aim at something, you know, whether it's flying or climbing mountains or going for runs or riding your bike, whatever, take aim and pursue getting better, pursue that growth and mastery and those goals that are motivating. And eventually you're going to have somebody go, hey, how do you do that? And that's the moment where it's like, oh, like this is where I turn it back for other people and where my own journey that was so gratifying to me is now serving those who come next. And to me, it's like, whether that's in a classroom or outside of the classroom, just out on the trails or whatever, I see it as identical now. Like to me, I'm a teacher in the sense that you can use that word, an inspiration, an educator, an informer, an inspirer, like wherever I'm standing. It's like, I know that's something I offer the world. And I think that's something each of us can like walk around with, and it gives a little more meaning when you realize, like, you know what, this stuff does give people reasons to put themselves together to be a little bit better. You know, even if, you know, whatever the pursuit is, you want to speed fly a little bit better. It's like, oh, now I'm paying attention to more details. I'm learning more things about how the world works, how the wind works, whatever it may be. Maybe I'm eating a little bit better so that I don't suffer so hard on the hikes, you know, whatever it might be. You start going, okay, I'm gonna start putting pieces together because I want to go a little bigger and I want to go a little further and I want to feel better while I do it.
Absolutely.
And eventually you follow that path far enough. And other people are like, how do you do that? And you're like, wait, how do I do what? Wait, oh, you actually think what I'm doing is cool. So, yeah, no, it's one of the reasons that, you know, you mentioned before we got on that you were starting to watch one of my old films from the FKT days, Journey to 100. It's one of the reasons I chose that name, Journey, is it's like, that's what we're all on. We're all out on this journey. And we're taking others with us where maybe we're just giving them that nudge to start off on their own journey, or maybe you're sharing some actual steps together. I guess that can stimulate some further conversation for us.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I'm definitely not worried about having or not having things to talk about with you, 'cause there's, you know, a laundry list of things I would love to dig into. Something about the journey thing. So Jeremy Jones, the big mountain professional snowboarder, not the like park professional snowboarder. There's actually two Jeremy Jones in the snowboarding world, which is wild. But anyway, he's quoted by, you know, with probably his most famous quote is, "The journey is the reward." And I think he even uses that on Jones Snowboards. Like, I think that's like their slogan. And I agree. I've always said that, like with anything I've done, you know, military, athletic pursuits, with flying, with skydiving, with all these stuff, like the journey is the reward. It's not like the end goal.
and not to dive down too deep of a rabbit hole, but you know, a lot of the problems that we've seen, a lot of the accidents that we've seen have come most likely from people just going too fast, too quickly, like trying to do what they see on Instagram and on YouTube and all that too soon. And they're like skipping the journey part. They're just going to the quote unquote reward. And yeah. I think that's like, it's dangerous. Obviously, if, you know, everybody talks about this, of course, just like slowing down, but really emphasizing the fact that like the journey is the fun part. You know, you want to get into shape, you can't, you know, like go around the board and pass go without doing all of the work to get there. You know, you're not going to wake up one day and have, you know, a 6 minute mile. You know, you're going to be running a 12 minute mile, and then you're going to be running a 11:30, and you know, it's like incremental. So I totally agree with you, but yeah, that was a huge rabbit hole. I apologize.
No, man, we're just seeing where this conversation takes us, man. We're riding the wave.
We're just running. Man, I had coffee like 8.5 hours ago. It's kind of worn off. So
no. Don't worry, I'm feeling it too. I've been in rooms full of screaming happy kids all day long, so my brain's cooked.
Perfect. Yep, it's perfect. Do you come across a lot of kids that aren't stoked on PE? Is that like common?
Not in my PE space. Cool. I mean, there'll be like bits and pieces, right? Where, you know, maybe a new kid comes in that's never had PE before and it's like a real struggle. So I'll have to come alongside him. And I'm just like, yeah, man, I promise. It's hard and it feels like you're way behind. But if you just stick with it for a few weeks, just even a few weeks, you don't give up and you just dig in, it'll get a little bit better. And you'll notice that you're keeping up a little bit more. And then another few weeks go by and you're right in with them. I like promise you'll get there and you'll be so happy that you did. And so I've like watched that like transformation process so many times now. Then, yeah, the kids that have like a rough home life, you know, it's a high poverty area. So I'll have kids that have, you know, trauma and difficulties from their home life, like things that young kids should have never had to deal with or have happened to them. And so sometimes there'll be some butting heads. And yeah, I'm okay with that. It's like part of the human experience, you know. I'll be like, okay, cool. Do we need to be on bad terms for a bit? Like, if we need to be on bad terms, I can be firm. I can be the disciplinarian. I can show up every single day and show you what a boundary is of how you treat people and how you behave, and still come alongside you and explain why I'm doing that, why I'm not allowing you to treat others in this way, why I'm not allowing you to slack off or do whatever you want. Because there is a path that leads to good things, and there is a path. I talk with my kids about, I call them my coffee cup rules. It's like, these are just like, I have a cup of coffee in my hand. If I let go of it, because I always teach with coffee because I'm like drinking coffee all day long. So it's like a fun metaphor for them. It's like, if I let go of my cup of coffee right now, what happens? And they're like, well, it falls and it spills. And it's like, yeah, do I get to drink my coffee? They're like, no. And I'm like, no. So like, that's just how the world works. I'm like, what if I had 1,000 cups of coffee? And I hoped and I dreamed and I prayed and I believed that they would just float in the air. And I dropped all 1,000 of them. What would happen? How many would spill? And they're like, well, all of them. It's like, yeah, it's just how the world works. And I tell them, it's like, humans are like this. We are part of the universe. There are rules for how we work and succeed and ways that we don't. And either you can make choices and be angry and be frustrated that nobody's your friend and people are frustrated with you and people are rude to you and no one wants to help you. But if you don't ask the question, well, why are they feeling that way toward me? And you're not adjusting your behavior, how you show up for people in light of these rules of how humans work and how relationships develop and how trust is built and how you make people like you, then you're going to always live with these problems. And you're never going to get to have the benefits of like being on a high trust team, a high performing team. It's like every team worth being on, every opportunity worth having in life is usually built on trust and responsibility. Showing up and being able to give people respect and show up and add value and take care of what needs to be taken care of. And so I like explain this to them as I'm like kind of holding a firm line with them. And, you know, there's usually a few weeks where it'll be rough and then we'll round the corner and I'll find things to start celebrating with them as they round the corner. And pretty soon we're running through brick walls together.
That's cool. So. Yeah. But I mean, it'd be special to be in a position like that where you can like actually change somebody's life just, you know, through mentorship essentially. I mean, it's, I don't know. I feel like, I'm really beating the PE thing to death, but like, I mean it when I say it was my favorite class, like across the board. And that, you know, ADHD, I was the same way. Like, I totally get that, you know, but it was just something that like, I actually felt like I could be myself, you know. But I remember seeing kids that like, weren't as stoked on it. Like, they'd be like, all right, we're running around the track. And I'd be like, yes, we're running around the track. And then there'd be like people that were like, no, like, I don't want to run around the track. And it's like, why would you not want to run around the track? This is awesome. Like, we're not sitting and learning long division, you know?
But don't you want to go fast? Let's go fast.
Exactly. I used to get yelled at, me and a couple of my friends would get yelled at recess for running too fast because it was dangerous. You know, we'd like run through all the kids sprinting. And I mean, I get it now. At the time I was like, what? Like, why? You know, I'm not going to run into them. Are you kidding me? I'm an athlete. but yeah, anyway, yeah, so like you mentioned, the wall behind you is covered in number plates from you know, races, from running races. I assume maybe some triathlons. It's hard to tell from my perspective, but
all of the above.
All the above. Yeah, so walk me through your origins. You already said, you know, ADHD kid. I totally relate. I was the same way. How did you get to where you're sitting now? And then we can dive into flying too, because this is a Speed Fly podcast. But I also want to hear about your background, because it is important and relevant.
Yeah, let's talk the journey. Let's do the you know, since it's a flying podcast, let's do the 30,000 foot flyover. So perhaps since it's speed flying, let's do the 2 foot flyover.
Perfect.
and yeah, so I guess, you know, I mentioned being the ADHD little kid that couldn't sit still. My first thing was being a skater punk, and I think that like taught me, because I was there to skate, right? Like, a lot of kids go to skate to do drugs. They want to go like smoke some weed. And I'm like, no, forget that. I want to land the next trick. And so I would just take my falls and take my falls and take my falls and then earn the trick. And I think, right, that you mentioned the adults telling like, oh, that's too fast, it's dangerous. I think there is this element of, right, doing dangerous things carefully. And that's where the magic is, Can you approach something that's difficult to do and dangerous to do, but approach it in a way where, you know, like with skating, there's good ways to fall on concrete and there's bad ways to fall on concrete. And can you mitigate those risks as much as possible while still sessioning out the necessary reps and, you know, taking your hurt, taking your skinned knees or whatever it might be, to earn what you want. And I think that was something powerful that I learned from that at a young age, just like going out and skating and having to earn that through a bit of pain. And then I broke my wrist. I finally made a bad decision. I was downhill skating in the middle of the night and hit a wet corner and slid out at high speeds. And I fell on an outstretched arm, which you're never supposed to do, and snapped my scaphoid bone. And my parents were kind of sick of the whole skating thing anyway, so they're like, no more skating while you're under our roof. I was a little frustrated. I was a little mad at the time because I'd built a lot of identity in it, and had a lot of like focus and like kind of, you know, the ADHD hyper focus in it. But that's when I discovered running, and I was in middle school, and the goal became, I want to break a 6 minute mile. And so I've humorously said that if I wrote a memoir, there would at least be a chapter in it that would just be titled From a 6 minute Mile, because it feels like so much of my decision making and my goal setting orientation came from that moment of hearing the teacher read 5:57. I didn't even care about the 57. I heard that 5 as I crossed the line finally on the last PE mile of the year. And it was just like, I did it. If I'm willing to work hard enough, I can do crazy hard things. And that set a whole trajectory of, I want to run on varsity in high school. I want to go to state. I want to make it onto a college team, and I want to get some scholarship money to run. And I want to go run collegiately. And then after college, well, during college, it was like, oh, I want to try to transition up to the marathon and try to go to nationals, which I failed to do. But it, you know, goals and goals. And then, okay, I'm going to bike across the USA when I graduate college, because I'd done one triathlon, a little off-road triathlon, while I was still in college. And it was like, okay, cool. I mean, I couldn't even swim freestyle. I had to do the breaststroke for the whole swim. And I ended up going over the bars like 3 times on the mountain bike, and literally sold it at the finish line, listed it to sell at the finish line. I was like, this is not good for me. I'm too competitive and don't have the restraint to not overdo it. So just had like this really bad. And then I broke my chain and had to like run the bike the final 3 miles of the bike.
God.
Was this so just like, it was an Xterra, yeah.
Yeah, those are brutal. That's cool, but goodness.
So anyways, I'd had this experience, but I bought a road bike at the same time. And the moment I hit 20 miles an hour on a road bike for the first time, it was like a brick sailed out of the sky and hit me in the head. I should bike across the U.S. And it just stuck for the rest of college. And so when I graduated college, it's like, I'm going to do this. My greatest fear at the time was this idea of waking up 30 years later, because it's like, oh, school's over now. It's time to start a career. And my dad was a workaholic. So like I saw that like pattern of coming home burned out and just like repeat, rinse, repeat. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to wake up 30 years from now and wonder what I did with my life. And so I was like, I have to do this now. I have to go bike across the USA right now. And then that kind of built the stage to be like, well, I now am a strong biker. I already have running as like, I've already pushed my running. Like I've tapped it out as far as it can go pretty much. I wasn't going to get any faster at the mile or any faster at, a marathon. I still got faster at the marathon, but at those shorter distances. And it was like, I need to see if I can learn to swim and like actually learn to swim. And so dedicated myself, signed up for a full Ironman. As one does, you go straight from an unsuccessful Xterra to full Ironman.
I mean, times are great, but it's not the full. If there's a big number, why wouldn't you go for the big one? That's really interesting.
Gotta go big. And so, yeah, dug into that and started doing sort of ultra marathons as sort of like the real focus was Ironman triathlon. But then it was like, oh, these will help me get more fit at moving for longer periods. So that became an obsession and the focus to unlock ultra endurance in, half day to day long capacity. And I would say, yeah, I dedicated from... I graduated in 2011. And so from basically then until 2015, I was all in on the triathlon and ultra running. I have between my high school running and collegiate running and all of the marathons and ultra marathons, I have 150 bib numbers on the wall behind me.
Wow.
So at least 150 different competitive events to like build that foundation. And then in 2015, I had a rollover car accident where I got ejected from the vehicle.
Whoa.
And ripped my ACL and LCL apart and had to have them surgically reconstructed, broke my shoulder in two places and broke 9 ribs and collapsed a lung. And the first doctor I had, he was like, yeah, you're going to let that part of your life go, when I brought up this love for movement. And I just remember sitting like kind of just dumbfounded. Like, I don't know a version of myself that isn't dedicating, like actively making, like I make decisions in my career to not take on extra responsibilities and duties so that I can have this adventure life. I like made that agreement with myself. I read a book called A Million Miles in 1,000 Years as a 16-year-old, and it lays out this proposition of, why don't we live our lives as great adventure stories? Why do we live the equivalent of a car commercial of man wants beige Volvo, man works 5 years, man buys beige Volvo? Like, that's why is that the summary of our life, when what motivates us and what captivates us are these stories of people going out and taking on incredible odds to adventure somewhere or to slay the dragon or whatever it may be. And so I was like, I want to live an adventure story. Like, that's what I want to do with my life. And so, yeah, I was just sitting in this hospital room I'm not a huge fan of David Goggins, but one of the things he says is like, the cookie jar, like having those things you've done that are really hard in the past where you can reach in and go, no, you don't know who I am. You don't know what I'm willing to do, right? That spirit of defiance. I think we have that for a reason. You know, we unhealthily apply it as a kid sometimes to be defiant against things that are good for us. But then I think sometimes we can be defiant in a way that says, no, I'm not going to relent. I'm not going to roll over and phone it into the grave. And so in that moment, I was like, okay, I'm realistic enough that I know I might not run a Boston qualifying time again, or I might not qualify for an Ironman World Championship again. Like, maybe those days are done. Maybe the knee damage, maybe the lung damage is too much. But I'm not going to relent until I get back to some version of what I love. And that was like what I anchored on. And so I couldn't run for a long time. So I started hiking. and started hiking the local hill, and hills led to mountains, mountains led to bigger mountains. Pretty soon I'm running into mountains that have like technical summit blocks. And so it's like, well, guess I need to be a rock climber now. So took up rock climbing full blast, learning the rope systems, learning, you know, how to build upper body strength, since I'd ignored that largely through my running career. So started training upper body and training for strength and power, to be able to do boulder problems. And really with this mission of being able to solo in the Alpine, and so really pushed myself that direction while acquiring like navigation skills and glacier travel skills and the works. I actually became a guide with Shasta Mountain Guides for a few years.
That's cool.
Just like built this whole journey into the mountains, all while rehabbing the knee and doing what was necessary to get the knee back. And eventually that came back and I was like, okay, I can go run 20 miles without my knee turning into a grapefruit. I'm not fast, but I can go do this. Let's see how many technical peaks I can like go link up on a weekend and then come back and tell my students about it and show them sick photos. And not long after that, I discovered the whole world of FKTs and I'm like, this is what I'm doing anyways. Here's my community. Here's my jam. Let's go. Plus there's no entry fee and I have all these medical bills to pay back.
Yeah. I bet. Yeah, so for those that don't know, FKT is an acronym that stands for fastest known time. Just in case people listening to this aren't privy to that info, but yeah, I mean it's basically like what I mean. You can explain it better than I because you have 100 FKTs. Is that right? Did you surpass 100? Or
yeah, I have 121.
Wow. Okay. I tried to count, but I lost. You know, it was a lot. So 121. That's amazing. I mean, shoot. I mean, so yeah, take us through that. Sorry to interrupt you, but talk about the FKT journey a little bit because it is pretty wild.
Yeah. And, you know, this is that film that we mentioned earlier, Journey to 100, kind of covers this. If people are interested to go dig that up, it's on YouTube and Outside Watch. But yeah, basically, they're speed records for mountains or groups of mountains or iconic traverses in the mountains across like a specific ridgeline, trail loops, trail traverses, you know, things all the way up to the entire PCT has an FKT on it. Everest has an FKT. So there's a variety of basically anywhere you can imagine that someone would want to test themselves, there's probably an FKT for it. And that's, I mean, there are still some like way out in the backcountry, like unfound routes that people can go find and be the first one to put up a time on. There's absolutely sort of undone link ups or traverses or peak groups. But yeah, I just sort of started progressing into it. And it's like that do dangerous things carefully. Early on, I started off like with a little bit of scrambling. There was always some sort of like a route finding or scrambling element. Very rarely was I interested since I knew I wasn't that fast anymore. And I wasn't that fast to begin with. I just had put a lot of time and dedication into it. So I knew on like pure trail running efforts, I wasn't going to like go toe to toe with top guys like that. That's not me. I'm not that guy. But as soon as you started mixing off trail route finding and terrain that makes people get gripped, get, you know, that fear pumping through your veins where it's like, whoa, this is a lot of exposure and I don't want to mess up. I found that I was able to quickly learn how to manage my headspace and how to really enjoy being in those places. So I was able to move really fluidly through spaces that other people slowed down in. And I'm like, oh, this is how this game is played. And then also being really using a fine tooth comb on my preparation to like figure out the most efficient line to move through a route where it's like, oh, okay, this guy ran this longer route to avoid this technical section. Can I solo that technical section faster? Oh, I can. Okay, so that gets me ahead of him. Well, what now? What next? What other pieces can I put together? They took a, you know, 4-hour rest at this place. Can I cut it down to 2? Starting to dabble with all the variables and learning how to play with sleep and learning how to play with fatigue and nutrition and all these different things to like keep the pack weight light. And so, yeah, I played this game sort of progressively. And especially toward the end of my 100 FKT push, started taking on like more difficult projects, that had more miles, more time out. And then eventually culminated for number 100 was Washington's 100 tallest peaks, which no one had climbed in a single season yet at that point. So I was like treading new ground to be the first to kind of show, yeah, just like Colorado 14ers, Washington's 100 tallest peaks can be climbed in a season. And I did it in 50 days, 23 hours. And the previous person had done like 410 days or something. So it was just like kind of a different approach to taking on the challenge. And it's been really cool since then. Since then, five other people have climbed them all in a season. And so it's really cool that now it's like become a thing. Like, yeah, doing the Bulgers in a season is an absolutely like doable task.
Right.
Yeah, and so, yeah,
the first guy that broke the, you know, whatever the 5 minute mile or whatever it was, like nobody,
four minute mile,
nobody had done it. And then one dude does it. And now all of a sudden, like everybody, relatively speaking, is doing it. You know, it's amazing how you, if you show that something is possible, then other people believe that it's possible and then they go do it. But it takes someone like yourself being like, no, like you can 100% do this in 50 days. Was the goal 50 days or did that, is that kind of how it played out?
That was kind of like the A goal starting out. The B goal was I have 70 days off roughly for my school summer. So it was just, can I do it in the school summer? Right. Because something that makes projects compelling is like when we have these life constraints that limit us. And I think this is right. This is what makes it applicable to anybody. It's like you have a job that allows you a certain allotment of time where it's like, this is what I need to do to make ends meet. And, you know, you can always adjust things to like widen that out. Like one of the ways I afforded my early adventures was I moved into a van while having a, you know, professional teaching career. So I could still pay down those medical debt bills and still have money to go on these trips to do these crazy things. And like being willing to adjust the variables like that is really key if you really want to have the resources to truly pursue what you want to go after. But yeah, like the constraint I had, if I wanted to keep my career as a teacher, which I really love, was I have 70 days. It has to go in 70 days. So that made it an interesting project, an intriguing project. But the A goal, cause I'd like gone through, like I said, and I figured out routes for every peak and all of the principal hazards I was going to be facing, every rock route I was going to climb, every glacier traverse I was going to cross, like anything that was going to be a roadblock, a hiccup, all the worst bushwhacks, because there are heinous bushwhacks. Like a lot of people are like, oh, there's a bushwhack up to, you know, go to this flying spot. It actually happened. I was just in Salt Lake City this last weekend and somebody's like, oh, I'm sorry, man. Like this is going to be a pretty heinous bushwhack. And as we're going up, it's like, dude, in my book, this is an open forest walk. Like this doesn't even categorize as bushwhacking for me. Like Washington, you can't see your partner. If your partner is 20 steps in front of you and they go silent, you don't even know they're there.
Right. They're
it's
gone.
Just so yeah. dense. Yep. It's so dense. It's ridiculous. And it can be that dense on like a 45 degree slope. You can be on like insane terrain, like insane steepness. And it's just like, you can't see anything.
Yeah.
So it was a crazy project. And like a perfect final exam, right? I'm a teacher. So it was like this beautiful final exam of like everything I'd loved learning and learning to move quickly through and putting this giant project together and then going, cool. Now I get to see if it's real. Now I get to go and make it real. It was a crazy 50 days.
I can imagine. I mean, what was it like plan? Because I mean, logistics for something like that is probably the crux. I mean, obviously you have to go and physically do the thing, but like logistically, I can't imagine how long that would have taken to just map it out.
I started about 6 months ahead of time. Okay. I kind of fully committed that it's like, this is what I'm going to try to do. And I was on the phone. I was on Zoom calls with, I don't know, five or six different mountaineers who had done link ups or climbed all the peaks, talking through different link ups and what would flow well and which variation is probably more efficient. And you know, before I even got on those calls, I did a ton of research and like compiled, you know, first, you know, found and then downloaded and compiled onto one map every GPX file I could find for any traverse or any climb up or down of any of the peaks that I could find anywhere on the internet. And then went through and discussed those with people who were in the know. to find out what variations were possible, what backup plans I could use if like a fire broke out over here. How could I still access these peaks? Does this really go? How bad is this part that's described as being really bad? You know, just all those questions. So, you know, 6 months of that on the lead up where I was putting time into it like every week. So it was a ton of front end effort to be able to have sort of this master plan where I could look at all these groupings of peaks as sort of like these chess pieces that could move around in this tournament, if you will, where it's like, okay, if this happens, then these ones go first. And if that happens, then I'll shift and go to these ones first. So it was always the next thing, the if then was always planned out. So that pivoting and adjusting was really easy mid game. So yeah, a ton of front end work went into making a project like that possible.
No kidding. And then just, I mean, obviously there's no way to really train for that other than like spending, you know, years doing what you did leading up to it. But I mean, I can only imagine the fatigue, right? Cause even if you're super fit and you're climbing mountains and you're doing this stuff, you know, you're still to do 100 of, I mean, and like I said, you're not walking up a trail, you know, I mean, I'm sure there were some trails involved, but for the most part, like a lot of those mountains are pretty remote, you know, and there's not a whole lot of traffic other than, you know, bears and elk and, you know, who knows, cats, you know, I mean, who knows, right? Yeah, that's impressive. When did you do that? Was that last summer or no?
That was 2021.
Oh, 20. Okay. So it's been some time. Wow.
Yep. It's been a minute or two.
How does the flying, like, where does flying come in your story?
Yeah. So, obviously 2021, this is after COVID has, broken out and, not a lot is known about it. And I catch it the first time and it seems like I never really bounce back from it, but I just keep trying to crush and push with more projects, right? Because I mentioned I have a 121 FKTs, not just 100. So I kept trying to push with some other big projects, but noticed that stuff wasn't quite right. And I wasn't moving as fast as I used to, and it hurt way more. And I wasn't like able to get into like the flow and the pleasure of it as much. And I caught COVID again, and it got even worse. And so like, I ended up catching COVID a total of 4 times that I'm aware of. And each time it was just like a stair step down where it felt like I just aged a whole bunch super fast and lost a ton of fitness. And I kept trying to just grind it out thinking, you know, cause we make these excuses with ourselves, like, oh, I'll bounce back. Like, yeah. And you just love the lifestyle. You love the dreaming. You love the process. You love the identity. I loved the permission it gave me to speak into people's lives, to like get up on a stage and show a film and like answer people's questions and inspire them to go chase their own pursuits and believe in their own dreams. And so like, it was really hard to want to let go of that. But I finally reached a place where it's like, I'm literally going into the headspace I normally wouldn't have to go into until like mile 70 of a 100 miler in the middle of the night, just to go out on a 1 hour run. Like this has gone too far. Like I'm just gritting to get through simple workouts. And that forced me to kind of like take a step back and go, something is clearly wrong in my body. And if I keep ignoring it, I'm probably going to pay worse consequences than if I acknowledge that it's real and I take a step back. But at the same time, it's like, here goes this whole way of thinking of my life, this whole adventure story that I'm in love with, this whole set of dreams and pursuits and ways of spending my time and ways of coping with difficult emotions. And I like knew I need something to be learning and growing and mastering. Like I love that process of growth and mastery. And I'd seen an X-Alps video back when I was kind of early in the FKT push. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Like maybe someday when my knees hurt on the downhill, ha ha ha. I'm too in love with just running right now. I love running the downhills. And it was like, well, my knees don't hurt, but my whole freaking body does. So I guess it's time to pivot. And Nathan Longhurst, who had climbed 65 of the Bolger's Peaks in Washington with me, he had taken up paragliding. And I was like, well, I better do it like right now so I'm not too far behind him, because he's an absolute stud of an athlete that acquires skills super quickly and methodically. And I was like, all right, if I'm going to be anywhere on the same plane as him, I need to dig in right now, even though I like still am feeling awful and I'm kind of depressed and I'm like struggling. And I remember, like, it was almost, I was glad that nobody knew who I was and knew my past, because I would go out to the training hill and it was like literally a struggle to walk back up the training hill was where my body was at. Like, I would have to like grit down and be like, get back up there for the next flight. Grit, you know, grit down, get back up there for the next flight. And it just like felt so humbling and like almost embarrassing to like have come from where I could rattle out six peaks with 20,000 feet of vert, sleep for a couple hours, and then go rattle out four more with 11,000 feet of vert the next day, and then take an easy day that only had 8,000 feet of vert, and then right back into a 10,000 foot day. It's like, I came from that to where it's like, I'm struggling to walk up the training hill. I'm struggling to be motivated to walk up the training hill, and it feels physically hard. But like I knew I needed to stick with it. And the piloting aspect, like immediately the moment I took flight the first time, it was like, yep, this is something that's going to be big in my life. And I'm going to put in the time, and I'm going to bring that dangerous things carefully, and all the mindsets I brought for like analyzing, you know, fear, real versus perceived, and, you know, trust in gear and equipment, and just like a variety of skill sets and mindsets. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to bring all this to bear, and I'm going to listen to a lot of different mentors. I'm going to find a lot of different mentors, and I'm going to find the different places I can practice the skill I need right now. So like right after I got my P2, it's like, okay, I need to go soar. I need to go find like a coastal soaring site so I can just log airtime. And people are like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you should only fly your home site for your first year. It's like, no, like I need the place I can get airtime where it's safe to get airtime is a coastal soaring site. So I just started going and soaring at the coast and getting a feel for my wing and getting a feel for like smaller maneuvers. And like just brought that kind of mindset of like, where do I need to go to practice what it is I need to practice? And spent that first season just going for it, like building the basic skills, getting used to launching in higher winds, getting used to kiting in higher winds, just like building that, you know, those fundamentals, if you will, right? You know, if it's basketball, it's, you know, dribble, pass, shoot, you know, just the basics, the fundamentals, and like drilling those down. And even by the end of that first season, you know, some people already started to be like, oh, you're pushing it too fast, too soon. But then one of those guys who had that like mindset, it also like saw me like pull up and launch after two more experienced pilots. They had been pilots for like 5 years, but who knows like how frequently they were actually practicing their skills versus just like, it's a nice day, I'll go fly today. And like I pulled up and launched first try after like they botched like two or three each. And he's like, that was pretty impressive. It's pretty impressive that your skills are where they are, being so new to the sport. And so it was like kind of fun that even those people who wanted to push back were like acknowledging that it's like, okay, clearly you're doing something here. It seems like you're doing it correctly, but I want to tell you, you're not doing it correctly because it seems too fast. But yeah, just being really methodical with my approach and noticing if there was a deficit or a hole and then drilling and practicing that thing, was a big part of how I entered the sport. And then same thing when I wanted to make the transition to smaller wings from, the full size wings, was like, okay, I'll get a 20 meter. I'll go play for hours and hours at the coast again, you know, soaring site where I can get a feel for that. Okay, let's try out somebody else's 18. Okay, that felt pretty good. Let's get an 18 meter wing. All right, this feels like an appropriate wing loading. Let's start flying this. Let's start getting regular reps and get a feel for how it carries energy and builds energy and dives and lands and launches and all that. And then finally moved into a 15 meter speed wing and started working that the same way. And then it wasn't until I was doing everything I wanted to do and was pushing that wing really hard that I finally was like, okay, I'll try a 13 out. And I was like, okay, this feels like the wing. And, you know, since then I've flown an 11 and it was like, okay, yeah, it's fun that it's fast. It's fun that it flies steep. It's fun that it rolls so easy, but I don't need that. Like it adds It adds more risk, and I'm not fully maxing out the 13 yet. Mm. I'm glad I tried it. I'm glad I tasted it. I'm glad I know I can fly it. But the 13, I still have room to grow, and it still does the things I want to do at my wing loading. And so I was like, oh, yeah, cool. Like, this is where I want to stay. This wing does what I need to do in the sport in the way I want to do it. Because it's like, I don't, the nice part of having followed this whole journey of, especially with Washington's 100 Tallest Peaks, that sort of felt like my Sistine Chapel, if you will, of like pushing my body to its absolute pinnacle and like manifesting something out of that with my skill set and mindset and physicality. And so I'm not really on a road to like try to prove myself up against others. It's like, I have things I want to do. I have some things I would like to experience, some ways I would like to be able to aesthetically apply the sport, if you will.
Sure.
To nature. And it's like, beyond that, I don't have any need to prove anything.
Right.
And so I feel like it's put me in a healthy mindset to approach it while I'm still pushing and I'm still like, you know, kind of moving quick. It's very metered and very calculated. And also like, I'll see somebody do something. I'm like, nope, don't need to do that.
I understand that. I understand that. Yeah. It's like, wow, that looks really cool. But yeah, I don't know if I want to do that. I don't know if it's worth it, you know? Oh man. No, I agree. And you know, just to touch on the, you know, 13 meter versus 11, sometimes smaller isn't always better. You know, I mean, there are times where it's fun to, you know, like for me, it's like, you know, a 9 meter, right? Like I really enjoy my 9 meter. I enjoy how it flies. I enjoy how it launches. I enjoy how fast and snappy it is. But sometimes it's nice to just slow down and make more turns, like have more time. You know, you're still flying fast. You're just not, you know, going 60 in a straight line. It's, you know, so there are trade-offs, right? To, like you said, less margin. And then if you're not maxing out, you know, the wing that you're flying, then why, you know, move down, right? So I agree with that fully. That's a really cool progression. And that's a progression that you've been on that a lot of people don't do. I mean, I have a different story in that I came from skydiving, right? So I'm like, oh, I fly a relatively small, you know, parachute. Like I can handle an 11 meter speed wing. So I went from a 15 to an 11 and I put a ton of time on the 11 and I loved it. And then down to a 9. Now I'm flying a 14 and I mean, post injury, right? But I'm actually committed to flying a 14 for a while. Like, I mean, that's like the goal. You know, I have a 6 meter, I have a 10 meter and a 9 meter. Like I've got all the crap. I just don't, I don't intend on using them, you know. Maybe the 6 meter with skis, but not with the intention of actually flying, right? Just skiing with the wing, you know, actually speed riding, not flying with skis on. That might be the only application, but we'll see. It's fun to kite in like 30 knots of wind, you know, it's a blast, but that's, and beyond that, it's hilarious because it's tiny. I mean, it is atrociously small. Like it's actually ridiculous. So, I probably shouldn't have it, but I do. But anyway, I'm curious, where did you get your P2? Cause you're in Oregon. Did you learn in Oregon or did you go to Tiger? Where did you go?
Yeah, I learned in Oregon from, an old fella in the sport named, Brian Kerr. He's been in it for 24 years, was a competition pilot back in his time. So yeah, learned from him just, in the Ashland area, Wood Rat, and, next to Mount Shasta, there's a launch called, Whaleback. So just, it was the most convenient place near me. I teach down in Southern Oregon. So Northern California and, the Ashland area, the Wood Rat area are just a 90 minute drive away. So it was pretty simple to jump in and learn there.
Yeah, it looks like fun terrain. Is that where you still, where do you fly currently? I mean, like if like going on your Instagram, where is that zone with the sporadic trees? It kind of looks like Chelan in a way.
Oh, it does kind of look, it does look like Chelan. Yeah, no, that's my local little hike and fly right above town on Hogsback Mountain. It's just right above Klamath Falls. I drive right past it on my way home from work anyway. So if the wind is the right direction, it's like, cool, hop out, hike up 1300 feet and get a barrel roll or two in. Yeah. So yeah, kind of a perfect way. It's really fun. You know, you go to a place where there's lots of people who do a thing and it's nice to have the community. of people who do the same thing as you. But the fun part about being the only one who does a thing is literally there's a texting chain with the little neighborhood that's right at the base of the hill. They'll all like text each other when they see me starting to hike up, like, oh, he's about to fly. And they get super enthusiastic, and it's like their own private little air show. They like get an absolute kick out of it. I'm the neighborhood fly guy. Cool. It's kind of fun. So
yeah, I always have like reservations towards that until I'm in that situation. And then I just embrace it. But like, there's a couple places I fly around where I live where, you know, I mean, up until recently, nobody really flies where I live. I live in Yakima. There's a ton of sites. I mean, a ton of spots that work really well. I mean, some really good spots too. And some that I've opened that are like 300 vert, you know, and it's like, you like land in an orchard. The, you know, people that are like working in the orchard think it's cool and they'll like clap. And, you know, most of them, you know, probably don't speak great English. So they're like, what is this? And I'm like, oh, it's a speed wing. And they're like, huh? And I'm like, yeah, paraglider, you fly, you know, it's cool. Like whatever. And it's just funny trying to like communicate. But before I go to those places, when I know that's probably going to happen, I'm like, oh, like, do I really want to like deal with having to say, like to talk to people, you know? I just kind of want to go like fly and just hike and kind of be in my own head and whatever. But then when it happens, I'm like, no, it's actually like, it's kind of cool because people are like interested. And, you know, even if they never do it, you know, maybe they are just, they remember, oh yeah, like that was speed flying and that dude was really nice and whatever like that. So to me, it's worth it in that sense. But leading up to it, I'm always like, oh, a little apprehensive. Like I really just want to be left alone. There's this little grass hill that's like 60 vert. I mean, it's nothing, but it's mowed. And it's like 40 degrees. It's like super steep and people, you know, run up and down and stuff. And the like the bottom of the hill is just adjacent to like a track, you know, at like a middle school. And it's my first ever speed flight was there a couple of years ago before we even moved here. I just like brought a wing. We were out visiting and my girlfriend was doing some interviews. And I remember like flying that. I was like, oh man, I wish I lived by this hill. And then like, you know, 6 months later, we live like two blocks away. So I'll go there. You know, it's very rare the wind is coming up it. And like, I need wind to launch there because I mean, it's literally 60 vert. So to call it flying is a stretch, but you know, it's a great place, especially for me right now, just post injury, like just getting reps in of launching and then, you know, sliding on my butt on the grass. And it's all like manicured. I mean, literally, like they mow it. I mean, it is like perfect grass. It could be a soccer field, right? It's beautiful. But the kids, like,
well, I feel like that's exactly where a lot of people go wrong. Is the moment they do something bigger, they downplay how much is still like available for them to learn and refine and hone by just doing the simple basics, right? If you can rep out 10 launches and landings clean, where normally you would, you know, if you hiked a bigger one, like you get one launch and one landing,
right?
And it's like, yeah, it's like being willing to go like, no, I know what I'm here for. I'm going to get 20 laps today. I'm going to get 10 laps today. And each time I'm going to work on something just a little bit different and get a little different feel. Like that kind of an approach is going to like serve, right? I always think about like, okay, sometimes you're in a situation where you want to do like the flight. And maybe the conditions are less than ideal. But if you've put in hundreds of reps in your like safe place to know like this is a situation that absolutely my wing will inflate and I can do it in this many steps and I have more than enough for that in this space for this flight right now, even though it's less than ideal, then you can make that really clean call because you have hundreds of reps to base it on versus just like throwing caution to the wind and going for it, or just hiking down, not really knowing if you could have gotten it. It's like, you can make that decision based on hundreds of laps of like, oh yeah, I put in the time on my 60 foot hill. And so I know that I can launch this crosswind or this much tailwind or whatever it might be. Like it works every time in these situations. And as soon as it crosses this line, I know I don't go. There's no guesswork to it. Like I've explored those options.
Right. But the only way to know that is to go do it, you know?
Yeah. Lots of reps in a safe environment.
Yes. And that's why I count them, but it's with an asterisk, you know, like I obviously know the site. So when I'm logging it, I'm like, it's at the hill, you know, I mean, it's 60 vert, right? I'm not making any turns. But launching, getting into my harness and pulling on toggles, you know, and then flaring and landing. I mean, so it is a flight. But it's just so funny because, like, the kids, you know, I don't know their, like, recess schedule, right? It seems to be all over the board, but they always come out and they're just, like, screaming and cheering and, like, they're pulling out their phones and filming. And I think it's, like, rad, you know, and they're like, do it again. And I'm like, it just went tail. Sorry. Like, I literally can't, you know, like my leg hurts and I just did 15 laps. Like, I cannot run anymore. So, but it's just, it's funny, you know, I call it urban speed flying. It's just like, yeah, I mean, big mountains inspire me, but so do like really small hills. Like, what is the smallest hill I can get off the ground and fly and land? You know, there's just like, and there's so many aspects to the sport where, like, unless you're, you know, doing barrel rolls a foot off the ground, you know, or rolling out a foot off the ground in like a big couloir, it's not cool. But, and I totally disagree with that. I'm like, no, like, I love to kite, you know, it's just, it's fun to just be attached to my wing. And it did, I mean, I've always felt that way. It didn't take me like not being able to walk for 5 months or whatever, you know, to get to that point. I've actually always felt that way. But it's just like, I love how you said, you know, people were telling you just to fly at your home site where you learned. And you were like, no, I'm going to go to the spot where I can get like hours and hours and hours of reps. Whereas like here, it's going to take me a year. It might take me, you know, a week to get the same amount of time. I mean, and that's, you know, I do envy living close to the coast in Oregon because Kiwanda would be pretty sweet. I'm assuming that's where you went. That is like, I haven't been yet and I'm dying to. I was planning on going this summer, but that got nixed, obviously. So, man, that place just looks like a vert ramp, you know, like in terms of skateboarding, you know. And I don't know, I brought that up last week with the Little Cloud folks. I was like, you know, part of me wishes that we could like have a half pipe for speed flying, you know, like figuratively, of course, like have just like the place to do it. And you just go, and if you're Michael Jordan and you want to shoot 1,000 shots a day, or you want to do, you know, 1,000 freaking kick turns a day on the wall, you know, on the vert wall or whatever it is, you can go do that with your speed wing. Like, man, I wish, but then there's this beauty of it where it's like, it's not that, you know, you need all the pieces to come together, and then it makes it sweeter because it's not always there. You know, I mean, I got skunked yesterday at this local spot I opened up, you know, 2 years ago, and went back today thinking that it wasn't going to be good because the forecast was bad. Took my dogs and it was like perfect. And I'm like, dang it. Like, why couldn't have it been like this yesterday? Right. But then, you know, you show up and you score, and it's like an amazing feeling when you get to, you know, put in 3 hours of flying and a bunch of hikes and, you know, on small hills, of course. But so there is beauty in that too, you know. I mean, I guess it wouldn't be as sweet if you could just like walk into the warehouse with the vert ramp and, you know, get to work,
turn on the wind tunnel and just start ripping.
Maybe someday. That'd be wild though, can you imagine? I don't know. Is the wind tunnel science with like wingsuiting is pretty cool. I mean, you know, and it makes sense. I don't think that would work with speed flying, but
I'm sure somebody could figure it out
someday. As long as it's not VR, you know, I'll avoid the, like, you know, video game style speed flying. I mean, there might be some place for it, but I actually think it exists. I think there's some, like, and I could be speaking out of turn here, but I think there is someone that's training people to fly. It might be paragliding, I'm not sure, but it's like a hanging harness situation, but it's VR. I've seen
Wow.
I know that it exists in skydiving for flying canopies, but on a really small scale. Like, not a lot of people have done it, but anyway, rabbit holes. But so, I mean, do you predominantly fly mini wings, speed wings, paraglide? Like, what's your favorite wing to fly?
Let's see. I've flown some 430 times this year. I would say most of them are either on my 18 meter code or my 13 meter Mirage, probably in favor of the 18 meter code, just because it's more versatile. I can launch it in more conditions. My home site can be pretty cross. And unless it's shallow enough of a launch, then unless it's like straight on or totally dead. If it's totally dead, I got to run like hell.
With the Mirage. But
with the Mirage.
Yeah.
But with the code, it's like versatile enough that like I can pull it up and get it off fairly easily in a variety of conditions. So probably most of those are on the code, and then a smaller percentage are cross-country flights. If I pull out the big wing, it's pretty much with the intention that I'm going to try to rip a cross-country for some amount of distance, which I had good success with. I flew a 111-kilometer cross-country flight from Chamonix to Visp, Switzerland.
Wow.
While I was over there in Europe over the summer.
Wow.
Right after Norway, right after just like sessioning speed flights in Norway with Nathan Longhurst, bumped down there and like switched over to the big wing and like ripped out a few big ones. So it's pretty fun. It's pretty fun to have like that range and versatility. It's a cool sport.
Do you gain, like, I guess when you're speed flying, do you gain from your paragliding experience? Do you feel like there's a crossover there?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There are definitely overlapping skills. There are definitely differences as well in how you fly and what you do and don't do with the wing. But I think what's nice about having both is that oftentimes it gives me something to do at a certain time of day or on a day, like maybe it's like, oh, I'm not in the headspace to go out and fly the 13. But cross country looks good midday today. So I'll pop up midday and go rip a long cross country flight. Go see what I can do out there. Or if it's like, I'm not really feeling like doing the long flight, I'll just get a couple morning laps on the speed wing or the mini and maybe a sunset flight. If it's a weekend or something. So it like gives those options to not sort of force something that you're not feeling in the zone for, which I think is pretty nice. I kind of love that same feeling with triathlon where it's like, oh, you know, my foot's hurt. Well, I guess I'll get on the bike instead of running today, or I'll go hop in the pool.
Yeah.
I think having that like versatility of sports, even though this is all kind of under the air sports category, it's like, yeah, but there are differences in how you do them and the risks involved with them.
Certainly. Well, I mean, cycling's not safe. My dad is a big cyclist, like 350 miles a week, I think, average. I mean, he's like an animal, still like races and stuff in his 60s, but he broke his pelvis a couple of years ago. A little like a bulldog ran out in the road and he tried to miss it and ended up crashing and just, you know, like high-sided basically, and landed right on his, you know, right on his side and like broke his pelvis really bad. So there's risk in all sports. I totally agree though with the triathlon thing. I did Ironman Arizona in 2018, the half, not the full. I wanted to do the full, but timing-wise didn't work out with my work stuff. I loved it though, because if I was like, you know, tired of swimming, then I would just ride my bike. And if I was tired of riding, then I just go for a run, you know? And even in the race, it was like, God, I really want to be done swimming. I'm like, okay, I'm done now. I can go ride my bike for 100 miles and then, you know, or whatever it was, 56. So yeah, that's cool. I think it's cool to have the ability and the knowledge and like the practice, I guess, to have the whole gambit of wings, right? Like speed wing, mini wing, full size, because it, like you said, it opens up more flying opportunities. And I'm very similar. Like, I just want to fly. So I haven't done any paragliding yet, but I do have a mini wing and it scares the living crap out of me, to be honest. Which is why, side note here, your videos of you flying the code they're so intriguing to me because it looks like you're speed flying, but I know, having flown mini wings, that like it is so hard to pull off, like just continuing, you know, I guess energy management is much harder to me, at least on a mini wing, than it is on a speed wing. Speed wings are fairly simple. You know, you just keep turning it and it's, you're good. But there's like something about the mini wing that it just wants to climb when I'm, you know, coming through a turn. And I'm like, God, I hate that feeling so much. So I'm trying to like wrap my head around being cool with it and just learning it, you know? So I've got a 14 meter Freya now and I'm stoked on it, but it does scare me because it's like, it's kind of a hybrid mini wing speed wing thing, but it feels more like a mini wing to me than a speed wing, even though it's, you know, the aspect ratio is still pretty small, relatively speaking. So, it's somewhere in between, but I feel that, like, you know, I don't know, going up feeling at the end of a turn. It scares me. So I'm really inspired by the mini wing stuff that you do, because it just looks like so much fun. It's like a kind of a slow motion, but not slow, but it's slower motion version of speed flying, especially when you're, you know, low to the ground and kind of proxy flying through trees and stuff. It's like super cool. That's definitely like kind of where I want to go. It's just a matter of getting over my fear.
I love it. Like, and I think that's one of the things that really helped me was getting so many laps where I was learning to manage the energy with that 18 meter code, and to keep it flying at the angle I want it to fly, and to keep it from boating up and out, and to get used to like just kind of staying locked in, and then also like setting that up where it's like, oh, okay, I want to come in low through this tree gate, and then I'm going to let it boat a little bit to lift me over this, and then I'm going to angle it enough to dive back between these next few trees, and being able to like, yeah, play with that, the desire, it's desire to like pop out and climb out of high energy turns. I feel like it makes it really fun and playful, and you're moving at slower speeds than, you know, with smaller speed wings. And so in a way it feels like, while there's more of that pitch dynamic to play with and control and understand, in a way it feels like you're playing the game on slow motion or easy mode, because it's like, okay, I'm going to set up this nice banking turn, and I'm going to float over here for a second, and now I'm going to dive through.
Right.
Yeah. It. I don't know. I kind of like it. I feel like at some point when I'm older, that will be my, you know, speed flying will just be like backing it up to just the mini wing and just having these like slow motion terrain sessions.
Yeah. I mean, it's so rad. It looks like the most fun you can have under a Ram Air parachute possible. I know a lot of people disagree with that because they want to be going 100 miles per hour, and I'm not against it. You know, I mean, I like to go fast too, but yeah, it's just slowing it down and still proxy and still hitting tree gates and stuff. It's super rad. That's the direction I want to go, at least for the time being, just because, you know, I don't know if it's safer, but at least to have more, you know, more time to make decisions and stuff's not coming at you as fast, I guess. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, it's the difference between, you know, riding your bicycle at full speed into a tree and just like running into that tree.
Right. One is going to hurt a lot more. Both might hurt, but at least, you know, at least one, you're not going quite as fast. It's so funny. So, I mean, you obviously are a man with very big goals. You set your goals and then you incrementally work towards them and you accomplish them. I'm curious, do you have any, what are your goals with flying? Do you have any big objectives, or is it just for the love?
I mean, I think what I'm intrigued more by is just finding sort of one of the things when you take on a new sport is it gives you new ways of thinking about the world around you. It unlocks like new adventures, new reasons to visit places and go exploring. And I loved that about when I made the pivot from triathlon into the mountains, because it's like, oh, now all of these mountains all over this side of the United States and around the world are playgrounds. All of these, you know, climbing crags or playgrounds. And so flying has kind of unlocked this sort of similar curiosity to go to really beautiful places, and to experience flight, in those spaces, in that environment, with that sense of place. And I think that's something that I'm searching for within this journey, is to go more interesting places. And to also like continue to tell inspiring stories to my students and to others. And, you know, I threw out a little, film of doing, a hike and fly version of the UK National Three Peaks Challenge. Me and, Henry George from, the UK, we released that together, and it's just simple. Like, nothing about the flying is dramatic or, like high level. It's just like, we went to a beautiful places. We climbed this known challenge where you climb the tallest peak in each country of the UK in 24 hours. But we flew off each one. And so it's just simple, straightforward, like just go have an adventure and integrate flight and see some beautiful places. And then bumped over to Norway with Nathan and got to fly down some gullies and over glaciers and over the fjords and Just this like beautiful experience that really pushed my flying forward. Getting to fly with him and in those spaces really moved the needle on my speed flying. And we're going to release just kind of a short little aesthetic film from that here in the spring. And then as far as another film project idea, I have one that I'm trying to spin up with a few other pilots. I want to call it Elements. That's the working title right now. And it's going to be focused like there. I want there to be really aesthetic flying pieces in it and some really creative ways of capturing some moments of flying, kind of tinkering with time, setting up some cool shots that like sort of convey the experience, right? Like a barrel roll, when you're the one doing the barrel roll, doesn't all happen at normal speed. Like in our own experience of it, like stuff kind of like goes in slow motion and it feels different. Time kind of warps, time kind of dilates, and to try to play with that a little bit within the film. But mostly what I want it to be focused on is like finding these really beautiful locations that sort of convey, you know, sort of the, you know, water, fire, rock, earth, wind, like conveying these elements where it's like, go find a place in Iceland where the lava is flowing and just find a way to like capture that aesthetically and to have flying be in some of the shots without it being high risk. And go find some epic glaciers with seracs peeling off and falling down and like capture flight in those environments. Just kind of like showing the relationship we get to have with nature and the experiences, the places that these pursuits can take us. And I feel like that's something I'm intrigued with, because it would give me that motivation to go to a place that will put me in a sense of awe. I think that's motivating to me at this point. And so it's less about like, oh, how, you know, can I get within 6 inches or can I rip a roll, da 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 da. It's more just like, oh, can I go to these and just have a flight that's deeply satisfying to me?
Sure.
And to experience these beautiful places and get to do something I love while I'm in them. So I think that's kind of the mission I'm on right now.
I love that. That's really cool. That's super cool. Yeah. I mean, there's so many reasons to do this, right? And I mean, that is a correct reason, you know. That's not one that, you know, people would be worried about you. Like, make sure you're okay, you know, because that's cool. And it's super inspiring. You know, it's inspiring for people that don't do this stuff, you know, because you have reach beyond the sports that, you know, we're talking about, right? Beyond paragliding and speed flying. I mean, it's obviously you brought in reach with you through the FKT stuff and the 150 days or 100 peaks in 50 days. And you have support from pretty major brands. I mean, am I correct? And do they support the flying as well? How does that,
I've been really lucky that I built really strong relationships with a variety of brands. I'm, you know, wearing my Athletic Brewing shirt right now. I've been sipping on one of their IPAs while we've been chatting.
Nice.
They've been with me since 2020 and have supported me. And obviously they had to taper their support down a bit as like I made the pivot from the sport I was making a big splash in to a, you know, lesser known sport that I was lesser known in. But they still have like supported me in the pivot. They obviously like got me a branded wing for my full size paraglider, which was really cool.
It looks really cool. I love the logo.
It turned out so good. It turned out so good.
Yeah, it's sick. I agree. I'm like, how do I do this with Speed Vector? How do I get a Speed Vector logo on the bottom of? I'm sure you just pay money, you know. But
yeah, I think if you have the business, then yeah, you just like expense it and take it out of your taxes. But yeah, so they followed me along. Path Projects has been a big supporter. They're just like a running an outdoor apparel brand. They've been with me since the Washington Bulgers, climbing Washington's 100 tallest. Cool. And then, yeah, I've managed to scrape up a couple newer sponsors. I've always really loved coffee. And so got in touch Wakako coffee makers. They make like handheld espresso makers and like nice. Pitched them successfully on a, hey, I can make espresso in the sky idea. Just like the simplest thing, right? It's like I'm up on in like buttery air and I'm just going to like make an espresso with an FPV view
cool.
with something beautiful out in front of me. And they loved it. I kind of guessed that they would love it because they have like stuff where guys are like riding a bike, no hands, and making an espresso. I'm like, oh, I can do that, but be 3,000 feet off the ground.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, had some success kind of building a relationship with them. And then Arcade Belts is another one that they're just kind of like a mission-driven brand. They have their Give a Damn initiative for like giving back and supporting good causes. They support Big City Mountaineers, which gets kids out into the outdoors, which is something like obviously I care about. Have managed to build some new brand relationships and maintain some old ones. And I've worked with a variety of other, I've worked with Viori. I've worked with, a spattering of others. I think between myself and then I've also acted as kind of an agent for other athletes at times. So I think between myself and the other athletes I've closed deals for, at this point in my athletic career, it's around $106,000 that, I've closed, which, you know, when you spread it out over the number of years I've been in the sport, I totally could have made more money just working a second job.
Right.
So like
right.
anytime people are like, oh, I want to be a sponsored athlete. I'm like, do you really? Are you sure? Like it's not actually that much income and you're going to spend all of what you get just to do the projects necessary to keep them as a sponsor.
Right.
Like it's not going to be something where it's like, cool. I mean, unless you're like the elite of the elite, then don't listen to what I'm saying. But if you're anything, if you're anything short of like Red Bull signing you, then it is a lot of work. And I mean, if it enables you to tell the stories you care to tell and have that, you know, income and freedom to go overseas on a trip instead of staying domestic on a trip, like sometimes it's worth it, but sometimes it's not. I think sometimes people assume that they want to go down that path because, maybe childhood them wanted to be a sponsored athlete, wanted to be a pro athlete. And so it's like, oh, I want to sign that athlete deal, which, you know, when I was 32 and I signed my first like official contract, that felt pretty good. Like, I'm like, hey, 8-year-old me, we did it.
Right.
It took a lot longer than we thought. I never even really saw it coming. I just was chasing what I loved. And I think that's where you have to start is chase what you love. And if you follow what you love, the doors will open in the right way. And then it just comes down to that, like, trust and responsibility. The same things I teach my students, like, can you show up? Can you maintain relationships? Can you deliver good value? Can you be a good ambassador for that relationship, for that brand? Can you represent them in a way that's admirable and respectable? And you can maintain those things and it can serve you over a number of years and be a win-win situation and potentially open some doors. But yeah, I definitely think people should take a hard look at themselves and what they really care to do and not do with their time before they just assume that chasing a sponsorship is the right move.
They definitely get their pound of flesh. You know, it's not, nothing is free. So even if they're, you know, I mean, you think about it, right? You're like, you get a job, right? They're not going to pay you if you don't show up, if you don't do the job, you know, and they're going to fire you if you don't do the job well, or if not to their, you know, standard or whatever. It's the same thing with sponsorships. I've had sponsorships in my past, you know, through other sports or in other sports, and it was cool. You know, I mean, it's great. Like, you get free shoes and clothes and maybe make a little money. It's awesome. It could definitely open the door for certain things that, you know, maybe, you know, you wouldn't have access to, and that's super cool, but it's not free. You know, everything comes at a cost. So that's really strong words of wisdom and advice there about sponsorship. You know, definitely go down that road if you're capable and you have the relationships and that's what you want to do, like, by all means, it's a good, you know, it's cool. It's a job, you know, it's definitely a job. So yeah, keeping that in perspective is important, because, you know, some of it is fairy tale and some of it is true. And there's definitely a line in there somewhere that gets kind of gray. So, but anyway, Where can people find you?
Like, so the easiest way to get in touch with me is probably on Instagram. I'm just Jason Hardrath, at Jason Hardrath on Instagram. I do have a TikTok. I'm rarely on there. I have Facebook, rarely on there. Does anybody even use that anymore?
My mom.
Hey, mom.
That's about it.
Yeah. So I also have a website people can go to if there's anybody who listens to this that is old school email. I have my email and all that on my website, just jasonhardrath.com. Yeah, those are the easiest ways to get in touch. Happy to chat project ideas and flying, any of the above with anybody. Definitely hoping to have some cool projects coming up in the near future and some trips to some cool places to fly. So always stoked to chat about rowdy adventures. So yeah,
I love it. Any parting words here? I want to be respectful of your time. I know it's getting kind of late, but yeah, I mean, drop some wisdom on us on our way out.
I think I'll just circle back to what I said before. I mean, we're all choosing, if you're listening to this, you're choosing to do a dangerous thing. The best learning is in doing dangerous things carefully. Make sure you're bringing both elements. Make sure you're approaching it with a methodical mind. And yeah, with all of the things around it, I think if you just follow the love, just chase the passion, it's going to guide you pretty well. You know, maybe you're going to have to listen to some words of caution from some sage voices around you. But I think that's served me pretty well. And then, you know, keep the main thing the main thing, and make sure you keep the secondary things and the, you know, whether it's a sponsorship deal or whatever it might be, like, make sure the secondary thing stays the secondary thing, and then the primary thing stays the primary thing. Because they can try so hard to get muddled, and then you find yourself doing the wrong things for the wrong reasons, and you're taking risks or taking on projects that you're not actually passionate about, and you're taking risks inside of them that you like are like, wait a second, why did I do this? Why did I make this choice? I think making sure that we stay rooted in doing things for our own reasons, for the intrinsic motivation, for what flows from within, is really important. And I think that can apply to something as simple as flying with the boys. Like, when you take a flight, like, remember to shoot for not just approval from others, that applause, those accolades, but make sure you're flying from that passion within. And I think that'll guide you away from perhaps doing some things that shorten your flying career.
It's very sound advice. Very sound advice. Well, thanks so much for doing this, Jason. I appreciate your time and you coming on. And I mean, man, like I said, there's a million things I could talk to you about. It's cool to hear your story, and I hope to be able to fly with you someday. That'd be cool. Maybe I'll run into you. I mean, it's not like we don't live that far apart, you know. You're only a few hours away, I think, maybe a handful. So maybe I'll make my way out to your neck of the woods sometime, and you could show me those local zones.
Or maybe we'll meet at Cape Kiwanda.
Let's do that. Let's call that a deal. I'll meet you there.
All right, audience. You've heard it. We've agreed. We're going to fly together at Cape Kiwanda.
Perfect.
You can hold us to it. You can hold us to it.
I love it. Right on, man. Well, you have a good rest of your day, brother, and we'll see you out there.
All right. Catch you later. Thanks so much.